นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะบุตรังธัมมังสังฆังนะโมสัมมิ Thought I'd offer some reflections to the community. Basically, just only recapping my trip before I forget most of it. The thing that kind of came up for me during the trip, visiting Abhayagiri, visiting home, being around Lumpur Peak, was this kind of feeling. There's a lot of tremendous amount of gratitude, just kind of being part of. I think I talked this with sometimes before, and during this trip, the image, visualizing something. Before I said, being part of like a huge infrastructure, instead of being just a cog in the machine, random doing random things and feeling not being in control, actually. Being part of an infrastructure that's actually generating lots and lots of wholesome qualities, and being part of this, and it's something much bigger than myself. Being part of like the Ajahn Chah tradition, going through the training, and seeing how that plays itself out over the world. When I visit monasteries like England, visit monasteries like the one in the U.S., how just kind of there's lots of similarities. And just how much care and attention those monks kind of pay to look after us when we're there. Yeah. So instead of being this part of kind of huge infrastructure, something came up during the trip, it's being part of the Dhamma wheel, being part of the Eightfold Path that is rolling on, kind of. Obviously, the part of non-self, causes and conditions, the Buddha arises, he teaches, inspires people, arahants become enlightened, they teach, and it just passes on kind of endlessly. And the other, or whereas you, and sometimes, maybe these kind of duality plays out in the mind as well, the other wheel that's also rolling on, that we all know very well, is also the wheel of samsara that grows on. And that's the wheel that just goes up and down around, the material successes. You get born, you have success, and you go, you get married. But then it just doesn't go anywhere. Whereas the Dhamma wheel, it has a purpose, it has an ending. There's extinction as its purpose. And the contrast was that, going home, seeing different things, families and friends and relatives. And just begin with just the Dhamma wheel, seeing Lumpur Peak, very well practiced monk, an arahant, who just kind of very very low key, and just focus on kind of generating benefit for the people around him. The rumor has it that he has also many psychic powers, so he can describe different things. But his own thing was just focus on the practice. Let's not get carried away with these ideas and concepts and stuff. First question he got, he kind of smacked it down. He smacked a few questions down, which is kind of amusing to see how people answer. The first question was, how do we, one person asked, is there any help? How do we contemplate Nibbana element? It's like, really? Watch your breath first. Once you watch the breath a few times, you bring us some piti sukha, then you can start thinking about the Nibbana element. Because people talk about Nibbana as a goal, but you don't know where it is, how it is, and how to get there, and what is it actually. So I said not to get too far into the head. So it's nice to think of these goals, but to bring it back into the day-to-day life of mindfulness, day-to-day life of generating. And like I said, he keep encouraging people to focus on samadhi, to focus on the calming the mind and calming enough to bring up a sense of piti sukha, of rapture and enjoyment. So once you do that, then it's easy to sustain the practice. But until you get there, then it's a lot of kind of forcing, you know, putting up with unpleasantness, just putting through in the hours till that happens. And he says, yeah, use whatever skillful means you have, but try to bring up as much sense of enjoyment, as much sense of well-being when you do the practice. And so that was something that I kind of found interesting, what he's focused on. And the reason why I want to come along this trip was, yeah, it was his first trip to the U.S. You know, see what how he kind of teach the Dhamma. What angle does he use? And what comes up? And the other one was, I think I've heard the story, but I can't remember. And something significant. Somebody asked him, can you tell us something about your relationship with Ajahn Chah? When you first met him, did something significant happen? Was it some very memorable things? Something like, you know, kind of, I forget what the word was, something significant. And he said, yes, something significant happened. And that was it. He went on to something else. So he obviously didn't want to get into it. It was a public space, so I don't know what happened, but he didn't want to get into it then and there. And like I said, he was focused was on himself, he said, and they keep asking about his practice, and he said, his purpose of being there was to help people further their practice. So he preferred questions regarding where they were at in their practice. And he would always kind of sometimes end the question of, okay, you get to there first, and then you next year or next time I come back, you let me know, and I'll teach you further. So it's just this sense of, okay, you know, this is what you need to get first, and then after that, we'll see what happens. Yeah, so it's kind of this encouraging to kind of put in the practice and get some results. And then you can talk about kind of deeper stages of the practice and not to get into too much into, you know, some speculations and projections, you know, what might happen, what could happen in the practice. And so that's what I thought it was a kind of an interesting aspect of his first trip to the U.S. And kind of contrast, you know, visiting home and, some of you might have heard kind of my relationship with my family. Well, it's kind of, we're close, extended family, but also there's not a tremendous amount of interest in the practice of Buddhism, which is fine. You know, we're kind of at peace with each other's ways or path. They're doing their thing, which is a worldly thing. And, you know, by some standards, you know, kind of my brother and younger brother, kind of successful lawyer, him and his partner, his husband, gay marriage is illegal now in the U.S., enjoying, you know, the good life, two lawyers, earning, I think, must be close to $500,000 a year, driving around big sports cars, living condominiums, spending a lot of money on food and different things. No idea how much food is. Like I said, he was buying me this kind of small bar, a few bars of this small chocolate. And I saw the number 21 on it. It's like, it can't be $21, it must be 21 pesos. It's like, no. Chocolates are expensive. Refined. What was the word he used? He says, good chocolate is very expensive. You can buy the Snickers for 21 pesos, but not these kind of chocolates that he gets. But as you see, but we have this kind of runny joke, though. He said, if you guys do anything interesting, I might be tempted to come out. I might be tempted to kind of go back to the wet leg world. Because they always say, oh yeah, are you done with, you know, kind of the monastic life yet? You come back to be normal. Come back to the normal way. And it's like, you know, successes, career, cars, houses, luxury holidays. You know, been there, done that. It's nice, but there's no meaning to it. You know, they're gonna get older, the body's gonna break down, and you're gonna die. And then what? Then what are you going to take with you? Nice, expensive restaurants, food. It's like, it is. It's nice. That's why people are doing it. But really? And in a way, it's fine. You know, obviously, if you know, and in their world, you know, seeing my cousins and in their world, they're happy enough. You know, certainly, you know, everybody's, you know, kind of doing well in a certain sense. But then from time to time, they get interested. You know, there's divorces, and of course, you know, the job, you get laid off, the global financial crisis, your house, you know, the house bubble happens. Then every so often, they usually get a bit of a shock, and they're kind of curious about, you know, oh, is there anything else? You know, how to cope with the changes in the world? You know, what about this thing about meditation? You know, why don't you guys do it? So they're curious, but then things go well again. They meet a new partner, new boy, new girl, new job, and it's like, it's all forgotten. It's back to, oh yeah, things are really going really well, and you know, why not come back and join us? We're going to Las Vegas for Christmas. You should come back and join us.
Do you share much
stuff? No, because I've tried to do that before when I was young, Mark, and I, like, make them really nervous.
Really?
Yeah. Like, oh, because come a Catholic background, they think I'm trying to preach and trying to, you know, kind of convert them.
Mm.
Yeah. So they're in the beginning, they're interested, like, you know, obviously, why did I give everything up to become a monk? But then they decided, sometimes it's a bit too challenging. My brother, who I'm very close to, my family, they just think, well, it's a bit of escapism or something, or some of them get the spiritual thing, but they also do the, you know, I'm not quite ready yet. My sister does a lot of meditation just because she's just a hyper, very tightly, very stressed out. So she uses meditation, obviously, to relax and to calm herself down, so in that way. But also, she has a kid and quite happy to, quite attached to her daughter. And then, you know, wanted to do the usual, the raising thing and the holiday and then having extra homes and this and that. Yeah. So, but I think there's some interest, but the grind of the day to day, they seem to be very busy. And yeah, so it doesn't allow for some kind of step back and looking at, you know, where are things going? And all this running around. Yeah, and like I said, they don't look like they're doing very much, but they're always very busy. It's like, it's hard to kind of tee up each other to have a coffee together or spending too much time together because they're busy running around doing things. Yeah. So it seems like life in the US is just very fast-paced and doing things. I guess very social, lunches and dinners and bits and pieces and concerts and things to go to. Yeah. I think the Dalai Lama said that, you know, the US, America, perfected samsara. They made it very nice, very enjoyable. And you just get sucked in to activities and bits and pieces and things to do. Yeah. And, but from a kind of monastic perspective, it's just, yeah, not very something that I'm drawn to, like I said, and that's the nice thing about this about this tradition, is yet that we can change our mind and do the worldly thing if we wanted to. Yeah, but it seems like, well. Yeah, I mean, there must be something more than just, you know, sensuality and, you know, lunches and dinners and holidays and relationships and bits and pieces. And it'd be interesting as things get older. And I think as people get older, there's a bit more interest in Dhamma because the body is breaking down and it's not bringing so much fun anymore that they start to think, oh, okay, well, maybe I should kind of train my mind and do other things. But, you know, when you're in your 40s and 50s and things are going well, then you just get lulled into it. It's like, you know, on a holiday. Things are nice, right? So there's no need to think too much. You're kind of hazed, you know, just enjoying, you know, sunning yourself. And it's like after a good meal, you're just full, sated, all the blood's in your stomach, not really thinking too much. You're just kind of chill out. So I think sometimes the sense realm can do that, and you just kind of keep entertaining yourself. You run from one restaurant to the next, to, you know, the lunches and dinners and clubbing and more concerts and holidays and stuff like that. And then working sucked up a lot of that mental energy as well. So it's just not a lot of time left to think about the bigger picture. You know, why am I here? Is this just all there is to it? Is there something else? Yeah. And sometimes it's the busyness of the world that just kind of suck people in. And samsara is like, you can see that samsara is just very sticky. It's always kind of things just to kind of suck you in a little bit. And then, yeah, and then you just don't, you cannot get out of it. But also I see it's kind of impersonal thing that, drawing my parallel with my brother, who was not that much younger than I am, just 1 year younger. We're pretty close when growing up. But also the other brother that I was drawing the parallels to is Lungpa Big's brother. So you have fully enlightened Arhat and his brother, and they look exactly the same. So one is a monk and one is in a suit. And of course, no interest in Dhamma either. And also he's doing the central thing. He starts off with a big Benz, he's a banking manager or whatever. And he's quite happy doing what he's doing. And yeah, Lungpa Big wasn't fussed that his brother was not so interested in Dhamma or meditating. He certainly wasn't trying to, you know, give him the talk or prodding him along. He says, it's just very normal. And he just relayed the story that when he was a young man, he was also studying business when he was in New York 40 plus years ago. Wasn't interested in Dhamma as well. But he said, he must have, in previous lifetime, he must have practiced a lot. When he started practicing meditation, it became very deep very quickly. And then he started interested in the Dhamma. And once he ordained, started out with just a temporary ordination, just, you know, I think his uncle passed away or somebody like that. And in Thailand, you ordain just to share the merit, the goodness with your relative when they die. Usually somebody in the family ordained for temporarily. And he did that intending to just for a range retreat, 3 months, and then going back to finish his MBA. But he never went back. Yeah. So he said the same story. He wasn't very interested in the Dhamma when he was young. And it's just, you know, by chance that he fell, you know, met Lungpo Cha, Ajahn Cha, and his meditation became very deep when he started to meditate, that it was drawing him into the holy life. And he's, obviously been happy ever since. And you see that, yeah, his brother, Lungpa Big's brother, just looks, it's like the same, it's almost uncanny, the smile and the face. And I think they're not that far from each other. And it's the same, so you see the kind of the wheel of Dhamma and the samsara wheel, it's just, it goes hand in hand, and then, you know, what we think that we're here, sometimes there's personal aspect of it, you know, you choose to be here, so you ordain or not ordain, should you stay here or not stay here, this kind of individual situation we bring into our path, really. On the bigger picture, you're just part of something. And whether it manifests as the Dhamma will or the samsara will, see what happens. And it's, the causes are already there. And you know, things just roll onwards. And it's, you know, on the bigger picture, yeah, it's just kind of the impersonal thing rolling onwards and doing different things. But seeing, you know, being part of the Dhamma will, yeah, you see, you know, how much benefit it brings to the world. You know, there's a lot of clarity, a lot of, you know, these wholesome qualities. While, you know, you may not be something to celebrate or focus in the world, it's something that's tangible. You know, the clarity of mind, you know, the sila, the foundation of harmlessness, restraint, that sometimes, you know, it's difficult to get your head around, difficult to get started. But as you live a life of restraint, you see more and more the power. It's something we live in the world that just always kind of encourages, you know, do whatever you want to do. Whatever you can think of, just do that. Whatever you want, just do that. Express yourself in different ways. And restraint is actually the opposite. It's like, yeah, just because you can doesn't mean you have to. Just because an idea comes in your head, you don't have to act it out. You can just, you know, kind of step back. Restraint gives you the power just to step back and say, yeah, it's just a thought, just an idea. It's just an intention. And we don't have to act through every single intention that come into the mind. We can say, okay, yeah, have a look at it. You know, there, whether, you know, to have another chocolate, to do different things. It's just an idea. And restraint does give you that power over time. And then, yeah, and then you can see that. And there's a level, and it also gives you a lot more confidence that, you know, that, you know, if you determine not to do certain things, that over time you do have the willpower to say, you know, yeah, I won't do this. I'm not going to harm another creature no matter what happens. I'm not going to squat the ant because I can. Not to squash this mosquito that just bit me because I'm bigger. I can't restrain myself. I'm just saying, yeah, okay. And just watch the itch and not worry about it. Yeah. So you can see, you know, this restraint that has this kind of innate power over time. And I don't know, it's just kind of you know, being part of the trip of Ajahn Piyik, seeing myself part of, you know, the Ajahn Chah tradition, visiting a Bhayagiri monastery, seeing lots of, you know, young monks, young novices in Anagarika training. Each year, you know, there's people coming through the monastery, the training, and intending to do wholesome things, and training young Americans. It's not easy. Like one of the monks was crediting Ajahn Pasno. He says, you know, how do you do it? You train these kind of obnoxious young Americans, full of conceit, to be really nice monks who are very kind of considerate and thoughtful. So I can never do that. And it's true, he's from Canada, and he gave up training. He says, this is just too difficult. I'm just going to train lay people and teach retreats. Because it's easier to train them for 10 days, and then they can go away and do the practice, and then come back later. But Ajahn Pasno, we did talk a little bit, and he says, yeah, you know, that was kind of his, he thought it was his role in life, was kind of put out there, and just, you know, out of gratitude for Ajahn Chah, who he saw that just, you know, put a lot of effort into training other monks, that he was, you know, going to do that, offer that. And instead of being a teacher, teaching retreats and teaching different places in the U.S., he says, you know, there are lots of good teachers around. I just spend my time in the monastery and looking after the, you know, kind of the people coming through, looking after the young monks and lay people coming through. And he said, but it's also, he felt, and he said that Ajahn Chah also commented on that, that is living in the community, training people up, that provides the fuel, the source up for your wisdom. Because it's very easy to be peaceful. Ajahn Chah had very strong meditation, so it's very easy to calm the mind. But he found it when he started up Nong Papong, dealing with the different issues that arise, dealing with the training other people coming along, that it gave him a lot of challenge him to kind of, you know, come up with different things and how to relate to people that are very different from himself, or relate to situations that doesn't come up when you're by yourself in the forest. And so it's just communal living brings up ways, brings up difficulties, brings up frictions, brings up different views and opinions, and then, you know, and then for us to work through. And it's not an obstacle to the practice. Ajahn Chah always pointed out, Ajahn Pasno reminded me, is actually that's part of the practice, dealing with the differences of each other, dealing with sometimes the boredom of the day-to-day life. And it's set up to be in a certain way. All monasteries set up to be kind of the regularity, set up for you to be bored out of your mind. So you're bored, that's good. You're doing something. It's set up for you to, it's not meant to be easy. So we don't get up at 8 o'clock in the morning and stroll down and have breakfast and then eat in the evening. We wake up at 3:30. It's just kind of, you know, that ability just to bring, you know, just to challenge what we think is physical comfort. Challenge just a little bit. But by challenge ourselves, we're going to bring, I think, hopefully bring some clarity and awakeness. Brings, you know, ability to find ways to cope with the difficulties that arises in situation, and find ways to overcome that in different ways. So it is, you know, Ajahn Chah talks a lot about going against the grain. Yeah. So, you know, the ascetic life, putting everything in one bowl, eating, you know, just before 12. Yeah, those things are meant for simplicity and restraint, but it's also meant to, you know, they're uncomfortable. But it's an ability to look at the uncomfortableness and try to, you know, find ways to deal with it, to make peace, to learn from it, to grow from it. So that is the purpose of living in the forest, living an austere lifestyle. It's not austerity for austerity's sake, but it's meant to bring up wisdom. It's meant to bring up ability to cope with the change, cope with difficulties, either through kind of letting go, making peace, being a bit cold, you know, kind of die from it, you know, sleeping a bit less, you know, see what happens. Obviously, the opportunities for you just to kind of find ways to either cope with the body or take naps in different ways. And that's why Ajahn Chah would, from time to time, just to change up the different schedule, allowing people just, you know, to kind of experiment and to deal with the different changes that come. But most of the time, it's pretty boring. It is just the same. We wear the same robe. That doesn't change with the seasons or the weather or the years. Each one the same bowl. So it is meant to be boring. Meant to board you out of your complacency. Meant to bore you out of your views and opinions, because you see the same views and opinions coming up. Oh, yes, yes. After a while, you're like, okay, I'll let these go, because they're not getting anywhere. And it's very boring. And you see your own kind of broken record of a mind, certain stories that just goes on and on and on about yourself and the people around you. And you realize, you know, it's not the truth. It's part of the picture. And you realize, yeah, okay, you know, I don't have to listen to this. I can just be in the present moment and watch really what arises. The judgment I have to people around me, is that really true? Is it not? Sometimes you find that it isn't. Like I was walking, looking at the mud kuti. And apparently when I was away, someone must have drove the car in there. And I was thinking, oh, these boys, can't leave them for 1 second. They drove the car and they ran into the laundry pole or something and then knocked it over. Because they tried to put it back, but it's very loose. And I'm thinking. But I realized, you know what? Maybe it's not them. Maybe it's one of the Thai visitors that visit. And I would have done it. But anyway, I'm not going to get too fussing over it. That stupid laundry thing is in the wrong place anyway. It's only good that we once and for all. I never liked that laundry.
I'll take it in data.
Huh?
I'll take it in data.
Yeah, I had an idea that that had something to do with this one. I was going to make any judgment. I was going to say, okay, well, tomorrow we'll bring up in the meeting and see. Huh? Let's see what happens. Yeah. Anyways, on the side, yeah, do not drive the car down to that kuti. You stop at the kuti above, before it, and you turn around. Yeah, because that path is not very good. And it's a nice kuti, but it's not very practical. There's bits and pieces sticks up everywhere, and it's not obvious how to maneuver the car around it. Yeah. No, I think that has to come out anyway. I think. Yeah. Did the whole thing fell in or something?
Yeah, but the bumping one fell out.
Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. That mystery is solved. but at least you see the mind. You know, sometimes like this view is too negative, and it's like, you know, it's not true. Because last time you form a thing, you know, you see something, you're like, oh, this person did that, or this person do that, and you realize it, and then you ask, and you look around, and it's like, no. You know, something else happened to bring around these things, that and it's not entirely true. And you step back and you see, you know, yeah. Or are you gonna allow certain negative thoughts to hold on and to influence your mood, to destroy your peace? Or you can just, you know, think of a way, give them benefit of the doubt, and see what happens. Yeah. So this ability just to kind of always trying to steer the mind in a positive direction, always steering the mind in a way that brings more peace and stillness. And yes, at the end of the day, you know, whatever, things happen. That's why you live in the monastery. It's always good for patience. So I was going to change this monastery to Wat Kanti, monastery of patient endurance. And it it's part of, you know, and you live in the Sangha long enough and you see, yeah, it's just part of living in the monastery, living with other people. Ajahn Pastor reminds me all the time, yes, living up with people can be very irritating at times, but that's the existential experience of living with other people. The challenges, But we don't have to allow that irritation to be part of, become reality, to be the only reality we know. We can allow, you know, we can see that, of course. But we can also look at the positive, right? Look at the inspiration, look at the great benefits that brings around living in the monastery. You know, just look at the, and the great thing, the great joy in being in the monastery is that you see people come in, you know, dark, confused, depressed, and they stay, a little meditation, they stay in a quiet place, they unplug from their phones and digital stuff, they stay away from the, you know, stay in a quiet place for a few days, for a few weeks, and literally, you know, their minds and their face starts to brighten up. And there's this clarity, there's happiness, there's peace. And then you just kind of gives you a lot of happiness, gives you a lot of joy just to see that, yeah, you know, the Dhamma is something powerful. You know, peace and clarity is something powerful, and it has its own power. And it affects people, you know, in a deep, profound way. And it's natural. And I'm always kind of amazed how quickly some people, you know, this lady that came a few years ago, and, you know, not very happy, and, you know, personal things happen, you know, going through a breaking relationship, and husband was gambling or something, and she's not really Buddhist, but mother dragged her here, and just like, you know. But then just a few weeks later, you know, gained faith in meditation, faith in the Dhamma, and just, yeah, it just became just really happy, at peace. Obviously, you know, her issues are still there, but just the ability just to, you know, to think things through, and have the ability just, you know, yeah, okay, you know, with the stillness of the mind, clarity, that she can go back and face whatever issues she has, you know, from a different perspective. Yeah, know that, yeah, her issues with her husband and his gambling issues and whatever, doesn't have to define her life. There's something else around it. And you see that, you know, kind of on a daily basis, and you see a lot of happiness that people get when they come to a monastery. Just to offer food, spend a few hours in the monastery, just walk around. Yeah, and then just be part of that, to be part of this kind of, you know, the Dhamma wheel, be part of something that's always kind of generating wholesome quality, generating goodness. Yeah, and it's kind of a major blessing. And yeah, sure, you know, and but not to lose sight that, yes, from time to time, you know, we fall off the Dhamma wheel, make mistakes, do silly things, not so pure with our sila. But that's okay. And I tell people over and over again, it's just the intention to continue training, just the intention to always incline towards wholesome state, to train yourself in the different kind of the spiritual qualities. Train yourself, find skillful ways to increase your faith, skillful ways to generate energy, enthusiasm for the training. Just reflect on, you know, how can I improve? How can I improve my practice in different ways? So every day, it's an opportunity to improve every day. It's a new way to look at, to find ways to purify our moral conduct, our sila. Every day is a day to cultivate more still, more peace, more stillness. Every day is an opportunity to cultivate wisdom. And yeah, and I find that, yeah, you know, kind of, but being part of something bigger, generating, you know, obviously we all have some association with monasteries and monks in our past life that brings us here, and then just again, and yeah, sometimes, you know, we fly off the Dhamma wheel, we do different things, you know, monks and lay people come to the monastery and leave for different reasons, and that's fine. Well, you see, you know, they come back and they're still trying to practice in different ways. So yeah, you know, the Dhamma manifests in different ways, different people, different times, and that's also okay. So everything belongs. And the wheel of samsara is also fine. I mean, that has this reason, has its causes as well. It's not like, you know, you're on the Dhamma wheel, you're so superior, or the samsara wheel, then, you know, you've gotten really off wrong. It is what it is. So everything belongs. Everything's fine. There it is. I was just thinking, like you saying, you know, you go to Baigyu and say, how is everything going? So good, I'm good. And Ajahn Sirpanya, who was using my training, would always tease me. He says, I'll be the judge of that, whether you're good or not. Yes, Ajahn. Yeah, I was, I'm good. No, are you sure you're good? But it's true. And it's something that I'm trying to encourage people to reflect on. You know, the world is good. The world's okay. And you're okay. I'm okay. It's all okay. Yeah, everything belongs. Everything has a purpose. So I'll leave that for you tonight. It's all good. Okay. 9 o'clock. And then we can, it's completely optional. Since tomorrow, it's a free day. So you continue sitting to midnight, or you can call it a night. Yeah.
The first is today, it's not. Or is it just because we don't have to get up early?
Yeah, just because we don't have to get up early. Okay. But generally, as the poster is coming up on the 10th, and just to warn, just to get people ready, that's the day that we will attempt to spend sit throughout the night. But that's another 10 days. Yeah. Okay, we'll pay respect.
Is it sitting in the morning,
then? No, because tomorrow is Monday, so the usual, it's a free practice day. So you can sit or walk whenever you want.
No formal meeting tomorrow. And breakfast is later, it's 7 o'clock.
What time is lunch?
The lunch, maybe just leave everything out and then come back later.